Tonight, we talk about poltergeists, moving graveyards, haunted hospitals, haunted health care. Richard Decep is with us next, and we'll get right to him on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Richard Decep back with us. First got involved with paranormal research in 1995 in the United Kingdom after attending an overnight investigation at a very infamous church. He spent the next 5 years investigating the haunted hamlets of Great Britain as a member of Andrew Wright's base team, and Richard co-founded the Boulder County Paranormal Research Society with his wife, Laura, after relocating to the United States back in 1999. Richard, welcome to the show. Looking forward to talking about your work.
Thank you, George. It's a genuine pleasure to be here. And if I may say how much I enjoyed your book about phone calls from the dead.
Well, you're welcome. And you've got a great one out called Haunted to Healthcare, which we'll get into. But I understand you're going to jail, my friend. What's happening to you?
I am. I'm going back to jail in the UK, a place called Bodmin Jail in Cornwall, England, which if any of your listeners watch a TV show called Poldark, which here in the States airs on PBS, he ends up getting thrown in there several times. It's a beautiful old historic jail with a pretty nasty haunting associated with it. And I'm going to spend some time locked up in the clinic to see what happens.
Oh, my gosh. I hope you're going to be okay. Are you scared?
You know, I've been there before. I spent some time overnight in the hanging pit at Bodmin Jail. They have a working gallows. And we got some excellent EVPs in there, some very strange results. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's how I spend my vacations.
Interesting. How many people were executed in that jail, do you think?
I want to give you a number, about 48 to 55, something in that region over the years. And initially they started tying them to a beam in the roof and pushing them out of the door. Stopped doing that when supposedly the head came off one of the poor victims.
Oh, geez.
And so they built a dedicated hanging pit, scaffold, gallows, all that kind of setup.
Assuming, Richard, most of those people were guilty and they died a horrible death, but it was their sentence, of course. But what did they do, these spirits of these dead people that lived horrible lives? Do they just hang around? What do they do?
Well, first of all, I think it's an assumption many of us make that we are dealing with spirits of dead people that are hanging around. Some of them are interactive. Some of them will speak. Some of them will answer questions. But just as many of them seem to be natural tape recordings, for want of a better term, no more interactive than the people you see on your TV set.
Simple as that. Interesting. How did you get involved in all of this in the first place?
Well, I grew up in my grandparents' house was haunted, and although I never experienced anything unusual myself, it gave me a lifelong fascination. I would go to the library. This was long before there were any shows on TV about this, and I would check out everything that I could by writers like Harry Price, Peter Underwood, you know, Hans Holzer, and that gave me a lifelong passion for not just the paranormal, but for reading in general, which has served me well.
You've got, several TV shows going on the Travel Channel this year, don't you?
I do. I have three going on right now. One is called Haunted Case Files, which really looks at some of the more interesting cases that I and other investigators have had. The newest starts next week. That is Haunted Hospitals, which focuses on, just as the name would imply, haunted hospitals. And the third is Paranormal 911, due to air in March. And that show looks at the paranormal experiences of fellow paramedics, firefighters, and police officers.
Oh, fantastic. Now, was Haunted Hospitals the TV show based on your new book, Haunted Healthcare?
I'd love to say that it was. I don't think so. I just think somebody decided it was an idea that time had come. I'd written a book called The World's Most Haunted Hospitals back in 2015. And I kind of fell into that being a paramedic. My love of medicine and the paranormal just kind of came together. And over the years, George, I've had more than my fair share of nurses, physicians, and patients come up to me once they know what I do, and they want to tell me their ghost stories, even very skeptical surgeons who don't believe in this kind of stuff. You know, they would say to me, oh, you're the ghost guy, huh? Well, I don't believe in that kind of rubbish. You know, there's no science to support it or anything like that. But this one time, and they go on and tell me about this, you know, truly bizarre experience they had in a hospital. And I just finally decided it was time to start telling some of those stories.
Well, good for you. You know, you live in the Boulder area now. I get up there every month for a taping of a television series called Beyond Belief, so we should get together on one of my trips up there, Richard.
I would love that. You give me a shout when you're next in the neighborhood, Georgia, and I would be delighted.
It's a gorgeous area up there. It really
It
is.
is beautiful, isn't it?
It was cold last time I was there, though. Oh.
It's pretty cold now. We've had some snow flurries tonight, but this is the only state in the union I'm aware of. I'm sure your listeners can prove me wrong, but where I've experienced all four seasons in one day on a regular basis.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when you came back from the United Kingdom, how did you center in on Boulder?
Well, I worked for a, initially was in IT. I worked for a computer company, and my wife and I were trying to figure out where to settle down, and it was a good location to be a computer network engineer, so Boulder seemed a natural fit. And
Excellent.
20 years later, I'm still here.
And you're doing paranormal full-time now?
No, not at all. I don't know many people that do it full-time.
Ah,
it's a passion.
Okay. All right.
You know, most people spend their vacations on beaches, taking cruises. I spend mine in old, dank, but historic buildings.
Well, lots to talk with you about, Richard. Then we'll take some phone calls and stories next hour from our listeners. Let's talk about the new work, Haunted Healthcare. The key is medical professionals and patients sharing their encounters with the paranormal. How did you go about finding these people?
It's not at all that difficult. The folks that I do conventions, of course, and give talks and so forth, and when people learn that I'm a paramedic, they'll generally, if they have a ghost story, it will segue into something that relates to a hospital or a medical experience. And I've noticed over the years, hospitals and psychiatric facilities, in the old days, of course, they called them insane asylums, seem to have far more than their fair share of paranormal activity associated with them. So people will just bring me these stories, and it continues to happen.
Do you know Sarah Grace, by any chance? She's a psychic, a paramedic. She was on the program Monday night with us. And
I've heard of Sarah, but I don't know her personally. But if she's a paramedic, she's all right in my book.
Yeah, it's, you know, you first responders are the best, I got to tell you. You truly are.
Well, you know, and one of my favorite, I must say, George, one of my favorite things about America, which is my home, and it's been very good to me, I'm now a citizen and very proud to be one, is that the tradition of volunteerism here in the United States, I respect for anybody that wears the uniform and serves, but it's amazing how many people in these communities are willing to do a job doing something entirely different, and then at night they'll go lace up their boots and they'll run into a burning building or take care of a sick person. So I love that about this country.
What is your favorite haunted hospital?
Probably would have to, no, not even probably. It would have to be the old Tooele Valley Hospital in Utah, right outside Salt Lake. It's no longer a hospital, but it has the same structure, of course.
It's like a Halloween haunted place now, isn't it?
It is. It's a full contact Halloween haunted house. So they took this old hospital, and the place closed down early 2000s. And they just left everything when they moved out. They didn't take the beds. They didn't take the x-ray machines. They didn't empty the sharps containers, which would contain the needle. I mean, they left pretty much everything in place. And so the people that bought it turned it into a combination community center and full contact haunted house attraction. Just so happens when people go through on Halloween, some of them know and some of them don't that the place genuinely is haunted.
What happened a long time ago to make it so haunted?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a long time ago. I think most hospitals have their ghosts. Certainly everyone I've ever been in has got a ghost story or two associated with it. This one also had, until just a year ago, a senior citizens retirement facility on the back end of it, an assisted living / skilled nursing facility. So you had people that were living actively in half the building. The other half was abandoned, and right next door is the town cemetery, which almost sounds too perfect to be true.
Well, that's true. Interesting take. Did you have some stories you could share with us about that area?
You know, I did. I've in 24 years of doing this, until I went to the location is now called Asylum 49. Until I went there, I'd never seen a full-bodied apparition, but that is the first and to this point only time, I believe at least, I've seen one. And I was going through the haunt on Halloween night, which how perfect could that be?
Exactly.
And I decided that we were going to after midnight, when the customers had left and the place closed down, we would be locked in until dawn. But before that, I wanted to experience what the guests, the customers experienced. So I went through on my own. And, you know, even knowing where some of the monsters, the zombies and so forth were, I still got more than a few scares. I got my heart rate up. It was very entertaining. And I saw this little girl dressed. I would describe her as looking kind of like Goldilocks, you know, or maybe Little Red Riding Hood, the red cape. And she was quite happily, based on her expression, pulling this lady into one of the side rooms. And I thought, wow, she's awful young to be on the volunteer staff here, because the place is staffed by young people that range from, you know, 9 or 10 years old to in their 20s. And it's a great place in the community for them to go. Anyway, I thought nothing of it until I got out at the end and mentioned to the owners, and I said, hey, guys, you know, the blonde girl was awfully young, wasn't she? I'm surprised she didn't get hurt with some of the people stampeding through here. And they looked at one another and said, we don't have anybody that young in here.
Oh, geez.
We think you saw Sarah.
And they've all seen Sarah, haven't they?
Many of them have, and it's kind of interesting, too. A number of people have written to me and said, as customers going through, they've seen the same girl in there. And it seems that when the haunt's in full swing, and by haunt, I mean the attraction, the energy of all those people coming through, whose only goal is to get scared in a safe, healthy environment, seems to fuel the activity. For 8 or 9 months of the year, the place is not that active. But then you get to September, October, November, when the haunt is in full swing, and things just explode. It's terrific.
Why does it seem, Richard, that children hauntings or spirits of children seem to be the scariest of almost any ghost? I don't know why, but they just seem strange.
Well, you know, Hollywood hasn't helped, has it?
No, that's true.
I love a good ghost story as much as anybody else, so don't get me wrong. But Hollywood definitely has kind of got the ownership of the creepy child ghost story down. Doesn't take that much makeup to make a child scary. You know, you watch those kind of movies and you see the adult ghosts, and some are creepy, some are not that much, but there's something about the kids, the way they move, the way that they are, that you're absolutely right. And I think that as a paranormal investigator, you hear stories of children who seem to be haunting a place, and you're instantly just kind of on edge.
You are. And then, you know, and Hollywood knows how to play it up, too, with the right kind of music and the sounds, na, 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 na. I mean, it's just creepy, isn't it?
Well, that's their job. I mean, why pay good money to go see that kind of movie if you're not going to be entertained and scared?
Well, that's true. Who would you say has the more of the paranormal experiences, the nurses, doctors, the paramedics, the patients, who comes across them more?
Hands down, the nurses, no question at all.
Uh-huh.
I think it's because, number one, nurses have more prolonged patient care. Doctors, and of course, I have nothing but total respect for both professions, but doctors are kind of very busy. They're bustling around, you know, seeing a whole lot of patients.
They're in, they're nurses, out. They're in and out.
They can be. Nurses, although they do also have quite the load on their plate to deal with, nurses are more likely to spend extended time with individuals. And I think they form attachments. They become fond of their patients. And I think that plays a role in it. But, by far the nurses, by an order of magnitude, I would say, George.
What did some of the nurses tell you about some of their experiences?
Well, a surprisingly common one, because I like to look at the commonalities. A surprisingly common one would be that when a patient passed away in a specific room, let's say a specific hospital room, afterwards they would hear the call button being pressed, or they would hear the sound of footsteps moving around in there, when they knew beyond all shadow of a doubt that this room was empty.
Jeez.
And I talked to one nurse who, they had a room that had a reputation for it. Always at a certain time of the morning, usually 2 o'clock in the morning, they would dread getting the help button pressed from a room everyone knew was empty. And the nurses would only go in pairs to go check on the room and reset the call button. And this was, of course, after the electricians had checked the wiring and replaced the components and declared that there was nothing wrong with the alarm system.
Did you ever have any nurses, Richard, to tell you that they were petrified, scared by some of these things?
Not too many, and I think it's because nurses are in order to do that job, you have to have quite the fiber. You know, you have to have the backbone.
Got to be tough.
Not, you do. I mean, it's a job that takes a toll on you as a human being. So they're professional. They're some of my favorite people in the world, are nurses. And so I almost would rather get on the bad side of a spirit than I would a nurse.
Well, like you say, nurses are there all the time.
They are the NCOs, aren't they, of the medical world, and they really, no disrespect to doctors, but they really make things happen.
Did they ever talk about witnessing somebody dying and then maybe seeing the ectoplasm leave or anything like that?
You know, a number of nurses talked to me about the fact that they'd seen some kind of light leaving the human body after death. And it's something that they would talk about amongst themselves, or at least amongst colleagues that they trusted, which was not everybody. But they often described seeing a light, a kind of globe of light that would seem to leave the body, rise upwards and then disappear. I encountered that a number of times interviewing nurses.
Why are hospitals and asylums seemingly the most haunted?
My theory on that is that if you look at what causes a haunting, generally speaking, obviously it's all down to energy, isn't it, George? And you tend to find very positive and very negative emotions are predominant in places where you get hauntings. So if you look at what a hospital is, it is all of human life, all of human drama played out on a very small stage. In other words, you have people dying, whether it's in the emergency room or up on the floor. You have new babies being born, new families being made. You know, you have people being given the best and the worst news.
Yep, you have happiness, sadness, all at the same time.
The entire gamut. And if you look at the amount of energy, emotionally speaking, that must create, you know, I believe that leaves a scar, a psychic scar, for want of a better term. I'm sure there is a better term, but certainly a residue, which is reflected in the paranormal activity people experience afterwards. And you know, something else that I found very encouraging was that medicine in general, but especially nursing, it's a calling. You won't hear that many nurses refer to it as a job. You know, they feel that they were called to do this. And I ran into quite a lot of accounts of phantom nurses that appeared to be still doing the job long after they passed on.
What? They're still hanging around the hospital?
Well, or dropping back in. I'm not sure. We've got this conception, don't we, that spirits just hang around waiting for something to happen. I think I suspect some of them come and go, that they're not, you know, in residence all the time, that they might go wherever it is that whatever awaits us after this life, and then drop on back when it suits them. There was a good example in a historic London hospital, for example, of a nurse who, very tragic story, she had been in charge of her own fiancé and had accidentally overdosed him on morphine, and he died.
And you're sure it was accidental, right?
They're absolutely sure, because she was heartbroken. It destroyed her, emotionally speaking. And after her death, she would come back, and what's interesting is nurses would say she was only ever seen when pain medications were about to be administered, almost as if there was a warning, you know, hey, make sure you double check the correct dose of this medication. Don't let what happened to me happen to you.
Don't make the same mistake I made.
But they all have this sense of duty, is what I've seen with nurses, George. And I love the fact that that seems to apply after they leave the physical body.
We're going to come back and talk some of the cases that you've looked at, Richard, in your career. And, of course, Richard's website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. We're talking about his work, Haunted Healthcare. He's also got another one called In Search of the Paranormal. He is an investigator of the paranormal for sure. But when we come back, we'll talk about some specific other cases on Coast to Coast AM. We will take your phone calls with Richard Estep when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM at the top of the hour. And I've got a few more things to talk with him about some haunted spots. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard Estep with us. His website, his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And Richard, for people who are emailing, wanting to know where to pick up your book, Haunted Healthcare, and the other, In Search of the Paranormal, I guess, amazon.com.
Yeah, I actually have 12 books out. They can all be found on Amazon.com. I also do sign mail order copies if people want to contact me by email. I'm happy to do that, or by Facebook.
Super. Let's talk about some various places. Tell us about the Black Monk House. What is that?
It's probably one of my most fascinating and favorite cases, George. It was a huge media event back in the 1960s. In fact, reporters from across the UK, where the case happened, were camped out on the lawn of this very ordinary-looking house, a house no different than yours or mine. The kind of house, you know, you wouldn't walk past and think twice about it if you went by in the street. But it was scene of the most violent poltergeist case on record. A figure called the Black Monk began to appear in the house and torment this innocent family. And the haunting got increasingly violent, according to those who witnessed it at the time, culminating in the daughter of the house being dragged upstairs in full view of several family members by an unseen force. Now, that story was one that I'd heard as a boy growing up, and it's fascinating me. I read about it in a book I heartily recommend called Poltergeist, A Study in Destructive Haunting by Colin Wilson, which is still in print. And I thought, this is terrific. I'd love to go to that house. I don't know what ever happened to it. And then in 2011, a movie was brought out called When the Lights Went Out. And you talked about scary movies earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually fairly accurate, or at least large chunks of the movie were fairly accurate. And it looked at how terrifying it can be to basically be under siege from a negative entity in your own home. And this revived interest in the Black Monk case. So I looked into the house and talked to the owner and was given permission to move in with a small team of investigators. And so I spent 5 days and nights living there.
Wow. That's a long time.
Pretty much. You know, but immersion in that kind of environment is great. It makes for terrific research. And we were there for 5 days and nights, moved out on the Friday. The following Monday, Nick Groff and Katrina Weidman from Paranormal Lockdown moved in for 72 hours themselves. And we both experienced some incredible activity in that house.
Did you feel as if your life was threatened by any means?
You know, I didn't. And this was one of the scariest places I've ever investigated, but not for the reason you would think. I'm a child of the 70s, George. You know, I'm sure many of your listeners are. And what's creepy about the house is that they never changed the decor. It was like walking into my grandparents' house when I was a five-year-old
boy.
Yeah,
time stood still.
It really did. I mean, to the point where there are actually Betamax videotapes lined up. You know, they've gotten a whole bunch of old artifacts. Not all of them are original to the house. Some were just added by the owner because they seem to fit with the place. But it was like being in a strange time capsule, if that makes any sense. And that, plus, you know, coupled with the knowledge that I was sitting in the bedroom or the living room or on the staircase that I'd read about since I was a young boy, it added a whole new dimension to the case for me, a lot of appreciation for it.
Richard, what's your definition of a poltergeist?
Well, that's the thing. This is referred to as a poltergeist case, George, but it really isn't. Or I should say the original case was. Poltergeists are kind of the shooting stars of the paranormal or the ghostly world. They shine very brightly, by which I mean they appear quickly. There is some usually quite violent phenomena around the house, which may include self-limiting fires being set without any apparent ignition source, pools of water appearing, objects moving, things being thrown, marks and scratches put on people, lots of disembodied voices, knocks, bangs, footsteps, those kind of things. But they burn out fairly quickly, you know?
Yeah.
It's unheard of, at least in my experience, to have a case like this that is still active over 60 years later. And so you can't call this just a poltergeist case. It began that way, and it became something else, which is part of its fascination for me.
Tell us about the serial killer called the I-70 Strangler and what happened there at his house.
So I was fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to investigate a place called Fox Hollow Farm, which is in Carmel, Indiana. And it's a very sad case, but also a fascinating one. The short version is that it was owned by a man called Herb Baumeister, at least it was until the late 1990s. Herb Baumeister was, on the surface at least, a fairly successful local businessman. His nickname was Weird Herb, so that maybe was a bit of a clue. But people said he was a strange guy, but a nice guy, the kind of guy who'd give you the shirt off his back. Now, we all, we all have those things we like to do on our own time, right? When my wife's out of the house, I'll get the TV remote control and I'll watch a whole bunch of stuff she wouldn't like, usually paranormal reality shows. When Herb's wife was out, he would go to gay bars in downtown Indianapolis and he would pick up vulnerable young men, usually men that would not be missed, and he would take them back to Fox Hollow Farm with the promise of swimming in the pool. There's a basement pool in the house, which is quite unusual. And he would then drug them and murder them. And he would drag the bodies out into the woods behind the farm, and rather than bury them, he simply either burned some of them, tried to chop them up, and left the pieces to rot. And got away with this for, the police believe, potentially 19 men, maybe even more, and a number of murders along the interstate, which is how he gained that nickname, the I-70 Strangler. And once he was caught, he fled the country, drove across the border to Canada, found a beach, and shot himself in the head. And, you know, there the story should have ended, a very sad, tragic case, except for the fact that the people who bought Fox Hollow Farm shortly after moving in began to experience paranormal phenomena. They would see the figure of a young man walking through the woods outside the farm and would disappear into thin air. And this young man had no legs. Animals would go crazy inside the house, and then apparitions began to be seen inside the house. And then perhaps the final straw, one of the young men who was a lodger there was attacked in the swimming pool, was pulled underneath and felt a pair of hands around his throat, trying to suffocate him, to strangle him.
Jeez.
So the opportunity to move in and investigate this case was one that I couldn't pass up.
And are these areas still being haunted by these entities?
That's definitely up for debate. I certainly hope that the victims of that crime have all moved on. I brought in a number of different professionals. As far as psychic mediums go, I'm not somebody that claims that ability. And I've worked with a number in my career. Some have been very good. Some have been, you know, not so good. And I brought in a couple that were highly respected in the local community. And they'd actually told me that as a result of the terrible events that had taken place at the farm, that negative things had been drawn in, had been attracted to that, like moths to a flame.
Now, the next spot, let's talk a little bit about Gettysburg, where a lot of people have reported all kinds of paranormal activity. What have you found?
I love Gettysburg. It's hallowed ground, isn't it? And I truly believe that every American should visit Gettysburg at least once in their life.
It's emotional.
It is, truly. And I wasn't born in this country, as you know, but it truly made me appreciate the freedom that we have today. You know, the young men on both sides of that war gave so much. And as a direct result of that, we have the free country that we all live in today. So Gettysburg truly is the kind of place where you should get emotional. You know, it should mean something to all of us. And I kind of fell in love with the personalities of the battle and of the history. And of course, ghosts are something that many of the locals and certainly the park rangers, they don't like to talk about. They would much rather I understand this totally too. They would much rather that Gettysburg was known for its history rather than for ghost stories. But many of the buildings have multiple reports of paranormal activity, and I couldn't pass up the chance to investigate a former Confederate hospital. There is an inn 8 miles outside the town called the Fairfield Inn, in a town called Fairfield. And many people don't know this, but while the climax of the battle was going on day three, Pickett's Charge was happening. This was where the Confederates held their 15,000 men against the center of the Union line. A smaller scale but extremely bloody cavalry battle was being fought in Fairfield. The short version is that a Union regiment of cavalry had been sent to Fairfield on the word of one local. It sounds kind of suspicious when you look at the testimony, but this guy had said, hey, if you send some cavalry, you can pick up the Confederate wagon train. They're not guarded. But they were guarded. In fact, brigades of Confederate cavalry happened to be coming in the same direction. And so the Union cavalry unit, the 6th, I believe it was cut to ribbons hopelessly outmatched. And the dead and dying from that battle were taken to the houses in Fairfield. And the Fairfield Inn, which is a fairly large structure and also had a doctor's office in it, was used as a makeshift hospital. So amputations would have been performed there. The brutal surgeries that the Civil War was known for would all have taken place in that location. And to this day, the residents of the Fairfield Inn, the visitors, report ghostly activity.
We're with Richard Estep. We're talking about his work, Haunted Healthcare and Other Paranormal Stories. Richard, what is the Villisca Axe Murder House? Where is that?
Well, that's in Villisca, Iowa. And this is really the second murder location that I'd investigated. Not that I find such cases any more fascinating than others. But again, we come back, don't we, George, to that violent emotion, that strong, intense emotion we discussed earlier. This was a location in which somebody, there were various theories as to who it was, but nobody knows for sure. Somebody walked into the house or was hiding in the house late one night and murdered the entire family, plus some visiting friends, some children that were staying over with an axe. And then left the house, never to be found. And so you have this, again, terrible crime which takes place in a fairly small location. The Villisca Axe Murder House is not that big. And the reports of paranormal activity there are off the charts, depending on when you go, of course, and what luck you have. So that was a fascinating place to investigate, and we got some excellent activity in there.
How about a school called the Farrah School? It's an elementary school also in Iowa. Why would a school be haunted? What happened there?
That's a question that has eluded a lot of people, George. So the Farrah School in the town of Farrah, Iowa, which is small enough, it's just 15 people, in fact, has no tragic history at all that we're aware of. It was a school since 1923, complete with, you know, play, much like you or I went to. Playgrounds and swings and slides and classrooms, all that kind of stuff. There was no death there that we're aware of, no murders, no great tragedy. What you did have was, I think, a lot of very happy children. And it's been posited that during the Great Depression and during some of the leaner years in the school's kind of early years, that this was probably the most stable and perhaps happy place many of those children would ever have had. It's haunted right now by either the spirits of children or at least something that imitates them, and a large shadowy figure who's known as the principal, who seems to be a little less tolerant of visiting investigated.
And people see things, what, like people hanging out windows and things?
What they see at that school is generally this big, and I say big, like 7-8 feet tall, shadow figure, which kind of stalks them through the school. At least one visiting investigator had his head slammed backwards into a coat hook in the area of the principal's office at that school. But not everything there is negative. I want to be clear about that. There is supposedly the ghost of a female librarian which haunts the school. And one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had was on the end of our first night there at Farrah. I'm usually polite when I enter a location, and so I say, you know, hello, good morning, and I'll say goodnight, goodbye when I leave. I happened to be walking outside, just getting ready to go home, standing at the foot of the staircase, and I heard footsteps upstairs on the third floor and knew without a shadow of a doubt that there was no way this was a flesh and blood person. I mean, we were locked in this building. And so half jokingly, I called out, you know, hello, and a female voice as loud and clear as yours is now, George, called downstairs and said, hello. And to this day, my teammates imitate my facial expression.
I bet. Nobody else was up there, were there?
No, we went charging up there, and nobody was up on the third floor at all. There was nobody else in the building. It was so clear. It was almost suspiciously clear. I didn't believe for a moment that it wasn't a real human being. But, of course, we'd been in the school all night. We'd searched it from top to bottom. And it's believed that that is the librarian who, if you are respectful within the boundaries of the school, will sometimes make her presence known in a friendly way.
It is amazing. What do you think of the possibility that these EVPs are really capturing the voices of the dead?
I think, again, sometimes they may well be, but I think we need to be open to other possibilities, you know? Too often we think of EVPs and apparitions and shadow figures and all of this. We shortcut or we default to saying these are dead people. But I'll give you an example. I was investigating a jail in Cripple Creek, Colorado, just last year, and I've been to this location before. My doppelganger was seen by another investigator. I was sitting in a cell with another investigator on the door so I couldn't get out, just doing an EVP session. This gentleman, a fellow investigator, walked into the cell and saw me and said, "How did you get back in here so quickly? How did you beat me in here?" And I said, "Sean, what do you mean?" And he said, "I just saw you standing outside. You were taking photographs." And I laughed and said, "There's no way. I've been in here for 30 minutes." And he went pale. The old stereotypical expression, you know, looked like he'd seen a ghost. I finally saw it in
He
action.
did.
He did.
Yeah.
But that's also kind of an assumption. And he said, what was interesting about it was, he said, "I know you, Richard. This was you. This was not somebody else. I wasn't hallucinating. This was you, except your shirt was a different color." So I was tempted to just assume, hey, that's pretty cool. This was a doppelganger, right? My own double image. Then I remembered the old saying goes that if you see your doppelganger, you die, and wasn't so thrilled. But, you know, having talked to a number of people, they said, you need to consider some alternative explanations here. Maybe this was a time slip. Maybe you will visit the jail 2 years down the road,
That could
three
be.
years, 5 years.
Richard, we're going to take a quick break. Let's come back and talk more and also take phone calls and stories next.